Cupid would be sent to find Iris and determine if she was able and willing to testify first thing Tuesday morning. According to Rochelle, who had spent the morning haggling on the phone with hospital receptionists, Iris had been taken to the emergency room at Christ Medical Center. When David arrived there at noon, he learned that she had left an hour earlier. He raced away in the direction of her home near Midway Airport, and he and Rochelle called her home number every 10 minutes. There was no answer. The same monstrous orange cat was curled up at the front door, one sleepy eye watching David as he cautiously approached along the sidewalk. He remembered the barbecue grill on the front porch. He remembered the aluminum foil covering the windows. He had made the same walk 10 months earlier, the day after his escape from Rogan Rothberg, following Wally and wondering if he'd lost his mind. He now asked himself that again, but there was little time for navel-gazing. He banged on the front door and waited for the cat to either move or attack. "Who is it?" came a male voice. "David Zink, your lawyer. Is that you, Clint?" It was. Clint opened the door and said, "What are you doing here?" "I'm here because your mother is not in court. We're in the process of picking a jury, and there is a federal judge who's somewhat upset because Iris skipped court this morning." Clint waved him in. Iris was laid up on the sofa under a stained and tattered quilt, eyes closed, a beached whale. The coffee table next to her was covered in gossip magazines, an empty pizza box, empty bottles of diet soda, and 3 jars of prescription drugs. "How is she?" David whispered, though he had a general idea. Clint shook his head gravely. "Not good," he said, as if she would die any minute. David backed into a dirty chair covered in orange cat fur. He had no time to waste and despised being there anyway. "Iris, can you hear me?" he said at full volume. "Yes," she answered without opening her eyes. "Listen, the trial is underway, and the judge really needs to know if you plan to show up tomorrow. We need you to testify and tell the jury about Percy. It's sort of your job as the representative of his estate and spokesman for the family, you know?" She grunted and exhaled, a painful racket that came from deep in her lungs. "Didn't want this lawsuit," she said, her words slurred. "That creep fig came here and talked me into it. Promised me $1 million. She managed to open her right eye and attempted to look at David. "You came with him, now I remember. I was just sitting here, minding my own business, and Fig promised me all that money." Her right eye closed. David pressed on. "You saw a doctor this morning at the hospital. What did he say? What's your condition?" "You name it. Mainly nerves. I can't go to court. Might kill me." The obvious finally occurred to David. Their case, if it could still be called that, would be damaged even more if Iris made an appearance before the jury. The rules of procedure allowed that in the event a witness cannot testify for some reason, death, sickness, imprisonment, the deposition could be edited and presented to the jury. As weak as her depo was, nothing could be as bad as Iris live and in person. "What's your doctor's name?" David asked. "Which one?" "I don't know, pick one, the one you saw this morning at the hospital." "I didn't see one this morning. Got tired of waiting at the emergency room, and so Clint brought me home." "That's about 5 times in the past month," Clint said, with an edge. "Not so," she fired back. "She does it all the time," Clint explained to David. "She'll walk to the kitchen, claim she's tired and short of breath. Next thing you know, she's on the phone calling 911. I'm pretty sick of it myself. It's always me who has to drive to the damn hospital and haul her back here." "Well, well," Iris said, both eyes open, glazed but angry. "He was a lot nicer when all that money was on the way. Couldn't have been sweeter. Now look at him, beating up his poor sick mama." "Just stop calling 911, Clint said. "Are you going to testify tomorrow?" David asked firmly. "No, I can't. I can't leave this house. Otherwise, my nerves will melt down." "It won't do any good, will it?" Clint asked. "The lawsuit is a loser. That other lawyer, Shaw, says you guys have messed up the case so bad, can't nobody win it."
David was about to return fire when he realized that Clint was right. The lawsuit was a loser. Thanks to Finley and Fig, the Klopeks were now in federal court with a case that was hopeless, and he, along with his partners, was simply going through the motions and looking forward to the end. David said goodbye and left as quickly as possible. Clint followed him outside, and as they walked to the street, he said, "Look, if you need me, I'll come to court and speak for the family." If an appearance by Iris was the last thing their case needed, a cameo by Clint was certainly next to last. "Let me think about it," David said, but only to be nice. The jury would get more than enough of the Klopex through Iris's video deposition. "Any chance we're going to get some money?" Clint asked. "We're fighting, Clint. There's always a chance, but no guarantees." "Sure would be nice." At 4:30, the jury was selected, seated, sworn, and sent home with instructions to return at 8:45 the following morning. Of the 12, there were 7 women, 5 men, 8 whites, 3 blacks, and 1 Hispanic, though the jury consultants felt as if race would not be a factor. One woman was moderately obese. The rest were in reasonably good shape. Their ages ranged from 25 to 61. All had finished high school, and 3 had college degrees. The Finley and Figg lawyers piled into David's SUV and headed back to the office. They were exhausted, but oddly satisfied. They had gone toe-to-toe with the power of corporate America and so far had not crumbled under the pressure. Of course, the trial hadn't really started. No witness had been sworn, no evidence had been offered. The worst was yet to come, but for the moment, they were still in the game. David gave a detailed account of his visit to see Iris, and all 3 agreed she should be kept away from the courtroom. Their first task of the evening was to somehow obtain a letter from a doctor that would satisfy Seawright. There was much to be done that evening. They bought a pizza and took it to the office. Chapter 38. Monday's brief respite from the fear of annihilation was long forgotten by Tuesday morning. By the time the boutique team walked into the courtroom, the pressure was back in spades. This was the real beginning of the trial, and a heavy tension filled the air. "Just get through it," David repeated each time his stomach turned flips. Judge Seawright offered an abrupt good morning, welcomed his jury, then explained, or tried to explain, the absence of Ms. Iris Klopek, widow and personal representative of Percy Klopek. When he finished, he said, "At this time, each party will make an opening statement. Nothing you are about to hear is evidence. Rather, it's what the lawyers think they will prove during this trial. I caution you to take it lightly. You may proceed, Mr. Finley, for the plaintiff." Oscar stood and walked to the podium with his yellow legal pad. He placed it on the podium, smiled at the jurors, looked at his notes, smiled again at the jurors, then oddly stopped smiling. Several awkward seconds passed as if Oscar had lost his train of thought and could think of nothing to say. He wiped his forehead with the palm of his hand and fell forward. He ricocheted off the podium and landed hard on the carpeted floor, still groaning and grimacing as if in enormous pain. There was a wild scramble as Wally and David sprinted for him, as did 2 uniformed bailiffs and a couple of the Rogan Rothberg attorneys. Several of the jurors stood as if they wanted to help in some way. Judge Seawright was yelling, "Call 911! Call 911! Then, "Is there a doctor here?" No one claimed to be a doctor. One of the bailiffs took charge, and it wasn't long before it was clear that Oscar had not merely fainted. In the chaos, and as a crowd hovered over Oscar, someone said, "He's barely breathing." There was more scurrying about, more calls for help. A paramedic assigned to the courthouse arrived within minutes and knelt over Oscar. Wally stood and backed away and found himself near the jury box. Without thinking, and in an incredibly stupid effort at humor, he looked at the jurors, pointed to his fallen partner, and said, in a voice that was heard by many, words that would be repeated by other lawyers for years to come, "Oh, the wonders of Crayox." "Your Honor, please," Nadine Karras shrieked. Several of the jurors found it funny, others did not. Judge Seawright said, "Mr. Figg, get away from the jury." While he scampered away, he and David waited across the courtroom. The jury was removed and sent back to the jury room. "Court's in recess for an hour," Seawright said. He walked down from the bench and waited near the podium. Wally eased over and said, "Sorry about that, Judge." "Silence!" A team of paramedics arrived with a stretcher. Oscar was strapped down and wheeled out of the courtroom. He did not appear to be conscious. He had a pulse, but it was dangerously low. As the lawyers and spectators mingled about, uncertain as to what they should be doing, David whispered to Wally, "Any history of heart trouble?" Wally shook his head. "Nothing. He's always been lean and healthy. Seems like his father may have died young from something. Oscar never talked about his family, though." A bailiff approached and said, "The judge wants to see the lawyers in chambers." Fearing that he was on the hot seat, Wally decided he had nothing to lose. He went into Judge Seawright's chambers with an attitude. "Judge, I need to get to the hospital."
"Just a moment, Mr. Figg."
Nadine was standing and not happy. She said, in her best courtroom voice, "Your Honor, based solely on the improper comments made by Mr. Figg directly to the jurors, we have no choice but to move for a mistrial."
"Mr. Figg?"
His Honor demanded in a tone that clearly conveyed the message that a mistrial was only minutes, perhaps seconds, away. Wally was standing too and could think of no response. David instinctively said, "How is the jury prejudiced? Mr. Finley did not take the drug." "Sure, it was a stupid comment made in the chaos of the moment, but there is no prejudice."
"I disagree, Your Honor," Nadine shot back. "Several of the jurors thought it was funny and were actually on the verge of laughing. Calling it stupid is an understatement. It was clearly an improper and very prejudicial comment."
A mistrial would mean a delay, something that the plaintiff's team needed. Hell, they were willing to delay it for a decade.
"Motion granted," His Honor announced. "I declare a mistrial. Now what?"
Wally had fallen into a chair and looked pale. David said the first thing that came to his mind.
"Well, Judge, we obviously need more time. How about a continuance or something like that?" "Ms. Karras?"
"Judge, this is certainly a unique situation. I suggest we wait 24 hours and monitor Mr. Finley's condition. I think it's fair to point out that Mr. Figg filed this lawsuit and was lead counsel until just a few days ago. I'm sure he could try this case as well as his senior partner."
"Good point," Judge Seawright agreed. "Mr. Zink, I think it best if you and Mr. Figg hustle on down to the hospital and check on Mr. Finley. Keep me posted by email with copies to Ms. Karras."
"Will do, Judge."
Oscar suffered acute myocardial infarction. He was stable and expected to survive, but the early scans revealed substantial blockage in three coronary arteries. David and Wally spent a miserable day in the ICU waiting room at the hospital, killing time, talking trial strategy, emailing Judge Seawright, eating food from a machine, and walking the halls out of boredom. Wally was certain that neither Paula Finley nor their daughter Keely was at the hospital. Oscar had moved out 3 months earlier and was already seeing someone else, on the sly, of course. There were rumors that Paula had also found someone new. At any rate, the marriage was happily over with, though the divorce had a ways to go. At 4:30, a nurse led them to Oscar's bed for a brief hello. He was awake, thoroughly covered with tubes and monitors, and breathing on his own.
"Great opening statement," Wally said, and got a weak smile in return. They were not about to mention the mistrial. After a few awkward efforts at conversation, they realized Oscar was too fatigued to chat, so they said goodbye and left. On the way out, a nurse informed them that surgery was scheduled for 7 o'clock the following morning.
At 6 o'clock the following morning, David, Wally, and Rochelle surrounded Oscar's bed for a final round of well-wishing before he went to the OR. When a nurse asked them to leave, they went to the cafeteria for a hearty breakfast of watery eggs and cold bacon.
"What happens to the trial?" Rochelle asked.
David gnawed a piece of bacon and eventually replied, "Not sure, but I have a hunch we won't be getting much of a continuance." Wally was stirring his coffee and observing two young nurses. "And it looks like we're both getting promotions. I'll have the lead, and you're getting moved to the second chair."
"So the show goes on?" Rochelle asked.
"Oh, yes," David said. "We have very little control over what's happening now. Varick is calling the shots. The company wants a trial because the company wants vindication. A huge victory. Headlines, proof that its wonderful drug is not so bad after all. And most important, the judge is clearly on their side." Another bite of bacon. "So they have the facts, the money, the experts, the legal talent, and the judge."
"What do we have?" she asked.
Both lawyers thought about that for a while, then both began shaking their heads.
"Nothing. We have nothing." "I guess we have Iris," Wally finally said and got a laugh. "Lovely Iris."
"And she's going to testify in front of the jury?"
"No, one of her doctors emailed a letter saying she is physically unable to testify in court," David said.
"Thank God for that," Wally said. After an hour of killing time, the three voted unanimously to return to the office and try to pursue something productive. David and Wally had a dozen things to do for the trial. A nurse called at 11:30 with the welcome news that Oscar was out of surgery and doing well. He could not see visitors for 24 hours, which was also well received. David emailed the latest update to Judge Seawright's clerk and 15 minutes later got a reply requiring all lawyers to be in his chambers at 2 p.m.
"Please give my regards to Mr. Finley," His Honor said indifferently as soon as the lawyers were seated, David and Wally on one side and Nadine and four of her henchmen on the other.
"Thanks, Judge," Wally said, but only because a response was required.
"Our new plan is as follows," Seawright said without breaking stride. "There are 34 jurors left in the pool. I will summon them back Friday morning, October 21st, 3 days from today, and we will select a new jury. Next Monday, October 24th, we will start the retrial. Any comments or concerns?"
"Oh, lots of them," Wally wanted to say, but where should I begin?
Nothing from the lawyers.
The judge continued, "I realize this does not give the plaintiff's lawyers much time to regroup, but I'm convinced that Mr. Figg will do as well as Mr. Finley. Frankly, neither has any experience in federal court. Substituting one for the other will not damage the plaintiff's case in any way."
"We are ready for trial," Wally said loudly, but only to retaliate and defend himself.
"Good. Now, Mr. Figg, I will not tolerate any more of your ridiculous comments in court, regardless of whether the jury is present."
"I apologize, Your Honor," Wally said with a phoniness that was obvious, "and your apology is accepted. However, I am levying a fine of $5,000 against you and your firm for such reckless and unprofessional behavior in my courtroom, and I'll do it again if you step out of line."
"That's a bit steep," Wally blurted.
"So the hemorrhaging continues," David thought to himself. $75,000 to Dr. Borzoff, $50,000 to Dr. Herbert Threadgill, their expert pharmacologist, $15,000 to Dr. Kanya Mead, their expert economist, $25,000 to Consuelo, their jury consultant. Throw in another $15,000 to get all the experts to Chicago, feed them, put them up in nice hotels. And Iris Klopek and her dead husband were costing Finley and Figg at least $180,000. Now, thanks to Wally's big mouth, they had just lost another $5,000. Bear in mind, David kept telling himself this was supposedly cheap money being thrown up as a defense. Otherwise, they would be sued for malpractice and face some rather terrifying sanctions for filing such a frivolous case. In effect, they were burning serious cash to make their frivolous case appear less frivolous. Such maneuverings had never been mentioned during law school at Harvard, nor had he ever heard of such insanity during his 5 years at Rogan Rothberg. On the subject of sanctions, Ms. Karras took charge and said, "Your Honor, this is a Rule 11 motion we are filing at this time." Copies were slid across the table as she continued. "We are requesting sanctions on the grounds that Mr. Figg's reckless actions in court yesterday caused a mistrial, resulting in unnecessary expense to our client. Why should Varick Labs pay for the plaintiff's unprofessional behavior?" Wally shot back, "Because Varick has a book value of $48 billion. My net worth is substantially less." Humorous, but no laughs. Judge Seawright read the motion carefully, and when David and Wally realized this, they began reading too. After 10 minutes of silence, the judge said, "Your response, Mr. Figg?" Wally tossed his copy of the motion onto the table as if it were filthy.
"You know, Judge, I can't help the fact that these guys charge $1 zillion an hour. They are obscenely expensive, but that should not be my problem. If Varick wants to burn its cash, then it certainly has plenty to burn. But don't get me in the middle of it."
"You miss the point, Mr. Figg," Nadine replied. "We wouldn't be doing the extra work if not for you and the mistrial you created."
"But $35,000? Come on. Do you people really think you're that valuable?"
"Depends on the outcome of the trial, Mr. Figg. When you filed this lawsuit, you asked for what? $100 million or so? Don't criticize my client for putting up a vigorous defense with good legal talent."
"So, let me get this straight. During this trial, if you and your client do something to sort of string things along, you know, drag out the trial, God forbid, make a mistake, anything like that, then I can file a quick motion for sanctions and collect some money? Am I right about this, Judge?"
"No, that would be a frivolous motion subject to Rule 11.
"Of course it would," Wally said with a belly laugh. "You guys make a great tag team."
"Watch it, Mr. Figg," Judge Seawright growled.
"Knock it off," David whispered. A few seconds of silence followed as Wally settled down. Finally, the judge said, "I agree that the mistrial could have been avoided and that it has caused additional expense. However, I think $35,000 is somewhat on the excessive end. Sanctions are in order, but not to that extent. $10,000 is a more reasonable sum. It is so ordered. Wally exhaled, another shot to the gut. David's next thought was to try to speed things along so the meeting could come to a merciful end. Finley and Fig couldn't afford much more. He offered a lame, "Judge, we need to get back to the hospital."
Adjourned until Friday morning.
Chapter 39. The second jury was comprised of 7 men and 5 women. Of the 12, half were white, 3 were black, 2 were Asian, 1 was Hispanic. It was slightly more blue-collar and slightly heavier as a whole. 2 of the men were uncomfortably obese. Nadine Karras had decided to use her peremptory challenges to exclude fatties instead of minorities, but she had been overwhelmed by the sheer abundance of girth. Consuelo was convinced that this jury was far more to their liking than the first. Monday morning, as Wally stood and made his way to the podium, David held his breath. He was on deck, and another heart attack would force him into the lineup against overwhelming competition. He was pulling mightily for the junior partner. Though Wally had lost a few pounds frolicking with Deanna, he was still pudgy and unkempt. As far as heart attacks go, he appeared to be a much likelier candidate than Oscar. "Come on, Wally, you can do it. Give him hell, and please don't collapse." He did not. He did a passable job of outlining their case against Varick Labs, the third largest drug maker in the world, a mammoth corporation based in New Jersey, a company with a long, deplorable history of littering the market with bad drugs. Objection by Ms. Karras, sustained from the bench. But Wally was careful, and with good reason. When a stray word or two can cost you upward of $10,000, you tiptoe lightly around anything you're not sure of. He repeatedly referred to the medicine not as Crayox, but rather as this bad drug. He rambled at times, but for the most part stayed on script. When he finished 30 minutes after he started, David was breathing again and whispered, "Nice job." Nadine Karras wasted no time in defending her client and its product. She began with a lengthy, detailed, but quite interesting list of all the fabulous drugs Varick Labs had brought to the market over the past 50 years. Drugs that every American knew and trusted, and some that most had never heard of. Drugs that we give to our children. Drugs we consume with confidence every day. Drugs synonymous with good health. Drugs that prolong lives, kill infections, prevent diseases, and so on. From sore throats and headaches to cholera outbreaks and AIDS epidemics, Varick Labs had been on the front lines for decades, and the world was a better, safer, and healthier place because of it. By the time she finished with Act One, many of those in the courtroom would have taken a bullet for Varick. Switching gears, she dwelled on the drug at hand, Crayox, a drug so effective that it was prescribed by doctors, your doctors, more than any other cholesterol drug in the world. She detailed the extensive research that had gone into developing Crayox. Somehow, she made clinical trials sound interesting. Study after study had proven the drug to be not only effective, but safe. Her client had spent $4 billion in 8 years researching and developing Crayox, and it stood proudly behind this wonderful product. Without staring, David watched the faces of the jurors. All 12 followed every word. All 12 were becoming believers. David himself was being persuaded. She talked about the experts she would call to testify, eminent scholars and researchers from such places as Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic, and Harvard Medical School. These men and women had spent years studying Crayox and knew it far better than the lightweights the plaintiff would present. Wrapping up, she was confident that when all the proof had been heard, they, the jurors, would have no trouble understanding and believing there was absolutely nothing wrong with Crayox, and they would retire and reach a quick verdict for her client, Varick Laboratories. David watched the 7 men as she walked away. All 14 eyes followed her closely. He glanced at his watch, 58 minutes, and the time had flown. 2 large screens were erected by technicians, and as they worked, Judge Seawright explained to the jury they were about to watch the deposition of the plaintiff, Ms. Iris Klopek, who could not attend due to health reasons. Her deposition had been taken and recorded by video on March 30th in a hotel in downtown Chicago. The judge assured the jury this was not unusual and should not influence their opinion in any way. The lights were dimmed, And suddenly, there was Iris, much larger than life, frowning at the camera, frozen, clueless, stoned. The depot had been heavily edited to remove what was objectionable and the squabbles between the lawyers. After breezing through all the background material, Iris got to the topic of Percy. His role as a father, his work history, his habits, his death. Exhibits were offered and flashed onto the screen. A photo of Iris and Percy splashing in the water with little Clint, both parents already morbidly obese. Another photo of Percy at the grill with friends around all preparing to devour bratwurst and burgers on July 4th. Another of him sitting in a rocker with that orange cat in his lap. Rocking, it seemed, was his only exercise. The images soon ran together and formed a picture of Percy that was accurate but not pretty. He'd been a very large man who ate too much, never broke a sweat, was a slob, died too young, with the cause of death fairly obvious. At times, Iris became emotional. At times, she was practically incoherent. The video did little to arouse sympathy, but as her trial team knew so well, it was a much better presentation than having her there in person. Edited, it ran for 87 minutes, and everyone in the courtroom was relieved when it was over. When the lights came on, Judge Seawright declared it was time for lunch and they would reconvene at 2 p.m. Without a word, Wally vanished with the crowd. He and David had planned to have a quick sandwich in the building and plot strategy, but David gave up after 15 minutes and left to eat alone in the cafe on the second floor of the building. Oscar was out of the hospital and convalescing in Wally's apartment. Rochelle checked on him twice a day, still no sign of his wife or daughter. David called him with a brief update on the start of the trial and put a positive spin on things. Oscar feigned interest, but it was obvious he was happy to be where he was. At 2 p.m., the courtroom came to order. The bloodletting was about to begin, and Wally seemed remarkably at ease. "Call your next witness," the judge said, and Wally reached for his notepad. "This will be ugly," he whispered, and David caught the unmistakable odor of freshly consumed beer. Dr. Igor Borsov was led to the witness stand, where the bailiff presented a Bible to help with the swearing-in. Borsov looked at the Bible and began shaking his head. He refused to touch it. Judge Seawright asked if there was a problem, and Borsov said something about being an atheist. "No Bible," he said. "I don't believe it." David watched in horror. "Come on, you quack. For a $75,000 fee, the least you can do is play along." After an awkward delay, Judge Seawright told the bailiff to lose the Bible. Borsov raised his right hand and swore to tell the truth, but by then the jury had already been lost. Working from a carefully worded script, Wally led him through the rituals of qualifying an expert, education, college and med school in Moscow, training, a residency in cardiology in Kiev, a couple of hospitals in Moscow, experience, a brief stint on staff at a community hospital in Fargo, North Dakota, and private practice in Toronto and Nashville. The night before, Wally and David had rehearsed with him for hours, and they had pleaded with him to speak as slowly and clearly as possible. In the privacy of their office, Borsov was somewhat comprehensible. On center stage, though, and in a tense courtroom, Borsov forgot their pleas and delivered his rapid-fire responses in an accent so thick it barely resembled English. Twice, the court reporter called time out for clarification. Court reporters are brilliant in their ability to digest mumblings, speech impediments, accents, slang, and technical vocabulary. The fact that she couldn't follow Borsov was devastating. The third time she interrupted, Judge Seawright said, "I can't understand them either. Do you have an interpreter, Mr. Figg?" "Thanks, Judge." Several of the jurors were amused by the question. Wally and David had actually discussed the hiring of a Russian interpreter, but that discussion had been part of a broader plan to forget Borsov, forget any expert, forget all witnesses as a whole, and simply not show up for the trial. After a few more questions, Wally said, "We tender Dr. Igor Borsov as an expert witness in the field of cardiology." Judge Seawright looked at the defense table and said, "Ms. Karras?" She stood and with a wicked smile replied, "We have no objections." In other words, we'll help feed him all the rope he needs. Wally asked Dr. Borsov if he had reviewed the medical records of Percy Klopek. He replied with a clear yes. For half an hour, they discussed Percy's dismal medical history, then began the tedious process of admitting the records into evidence. It would have taken hours if not for the remarkable cooperation of the defense. Ms. Karras could have objected to a lot of the material, but she wanted everything laid out for the jurors. By the time the 4-inch-thick file was admitted, several of them were struggling to stay awake. The testimony improved dramatically with the aid of a greatly enlarged diagram of a human heart. It was presented on a large screen, and Dr. Borsoff was given wide latitude in describing it for the jury. Walking back and forth in front of the screen, and with the aid of a pointing stick, he did a decent job of describing the valves, chambers, and arteries. When he said something that no one understood, Wally helpfully repeated it for the benefit of the others. Wally knew this would be the easy portion of his testimony, and he took his time. The good doctor seemed to know his stuff, but then any second-year med student was well-versed in this material. When the tutorial was finally finished, Borsoff returned to the witness stand. 2 months before he died in his sleep, Percy had undergone his annual physical, complete with EKG and echocardiogram, thus providing Dr. Borsoff with something to talk about. Wally handed him the echo report, and the two spent 15 minutes discussing the basics of an echocardiogram. Percy showed a marked decrease in the regurgitation of blood from the left ventricle chamber. David took a deep breath as lawyer and witness waded into the minefield of technical medical jargon. It was a disaster from the very beginning. Krayok supposedly damaged the mitral valve in such a way that it impeded the flow of blood as it was being pumped out of the heart. In an attempt to explain this, Borsoff used the term left ventricle ejection fraction. When asked to clarify this for the jury, Borsoff said, "The ejection fraction is actually the ventricle volume at end diastole minus end systole, the ventricle volume, and that divided by the total volume times 100 is the ejection fraction." Such language was incomprehensible to laymen when delivered in slow, precise English. Out of Dr. Borsoff's mouth, it was nothing but gibberish and sadly comical. Nadine Karras rose and said, "Your Honor, please." Judge Seawright shook his head as if he'd been slapped and said, "Come on, Mr. Figg." Three of the jurors were glaring at David as if he had insulted them. A couple were suppressing chuckles. Treading water, Wally asked his witness to speak slowly, clearly, and if possible, in easier language. They plodded along, Borsoff trying his best, Wally repeating virtually everything he said until some clarity was achieved, but not much and not nearly enough. Borsoff discussed the grading of mitral insufficiency, the regurgitation of the left atrial area, and the level of severity of the mitral regurgitation. Long after the jury gave up, Wally asked a series of questions about the interpretation of the echocardiogram, and it prompted this response. "If the ventricle was totally symmetrical and had no discrepancies in the wall motion or geometry, it would be a prolate ellipsoid. Just defines flat end and pointed end and gentle curve, an ellipsoid fraction. So the ventricle would contract down, would still be a prolate ellipsoid, but all walls would move except the plane of mitral valve." The court reporter raised her hand and blurted, I'm sorry, Your Honor, but I'm not getting this." Judge Seawright's eyes closed, his head was down, as if he, too, had given up and just wanted Borsoff to finish and get out of the courtroom. 15-minute recess," he mumbled. Wally and David sat silent before two untouched cups of coffee in the small cafe. It was 4:30 Monday afternoon, and both felt as though they'd spent a month in Seawright's courtroom. Neither wanted to see it again. While David was stunned by Borsoff's thoroughly discreditable performance, he was also thinking about Wally's drinking. He wasn't drunk and didn't appear under the influence, but any return to the bottle for an alcoholic was troubling. He wanted to quiz him to see if he was okay, but the place and time seemed inappropriate. Why bring up such a dreadful subject under such miserable circumstances? Wally stared at a spot on the floor, motionless, off in another world. "I don't think the jury is with us," David said offhandedly, no effort at humor. But Wally smiled and said, "The jury hates us, and I don't blame them. We won't make it past summary judgment. As soon as we finish our case, Seawright will throw us out of court." "So a quick end? Can't blame him for that." "A quick and merciful end," Wally said, still staring at the floor. "What will it mean for the other issues, like sanctions and malpractice?" "Who knows? I think the malpractice cases will go away. You can't get sued just because you lose a case at trial. Sanctions, though, could be another story. I can see Varick going for our jugulars, claiming the case had no merit." David finally took a sip of coffee. Wally said, "I keep thinking about Jerry Alessandro's.
I'd like to catch him in an alley and beat him senseless with a baseball bat.
Now, that's a pleasant thought.
We better go. Let's finish with Borisov and get him out of here.
For the next hour, the courtroom suffered through the tortuous process of watching the video of Percy's echocardiogram, while Dr. Borisov attempted to describe what they were seeing. With the lights dimmed, several of the jurors began to nod off. When the video ended, Borisov returned to the witness chair.
"How much longer, Mr. Figg?" the judge asked.
5 minutes.
"Proceed."
Even the flimsiest of cases require certain magical language. Wally wanted to slip it in quickly while the jury was comatose, and just maybe the defense was ready to go home.
"Now, Dr. Borisov, do you have an opinion, based on a reasonable degree of medical certainty, as to the cause of the death of Mr. Percy Klopek?"
"I do."
David was watching Nadine Karras, who, with little effort, could have excluded any and all expert opinions from Borisov on numerous grounds. She seemed to have no interest in doing so.
"And what is that opinion?" Wally asked.
"My opinion, based on a reasonable degree of medical certainty, is that Mr. Klopek died of acute myocardial infarction, or heart attack."
Borisov offered this opinion slowly, his English much clearer.
"And do you have an opinion as to the cause of his heart attack?"
"My opinion, based on a reasonable degree of medical certainty, is that the heart attack was caused by an enlarged left ventricle chamber."
"And do you have an opinion as to what caused the enlargement of the left ventricle chamber?"
"My opinion, based on a reasonable degree of medical certainty, is that the enlargement was caused by the ingestion of the cholesterol drug Creox."
At least four of the jurors were shaking their heads. Two others looked as though they wanted to stand and yell obscenities at Borisov. At 6 p.m., the witness was finally excused and the jury sent home.
"Adjourned until 9 o'clock in the morning," Judge Seawright said.
Riding back to the office, Wally fell asleep in the passenger seat. Stuck in traffic, David checked his cell phone, then went online to check the market. Varick's stock had jumped from $31.50 to $35. News of the company's imminent victory was spreading fast. Chapter 40. During her first 2 months on Earth, little Emma had yet to sleep through the night. Down by 8, she was usually up by 11 for a quick snack and a clean diaper. A lengthy session of floor walking and chair rocking knocked her out by midnight, but by 3 a.m. she was hungry again. At first, Helen gamely clung to the plan of breastfeeding, but after 6 weeks, she was exhausted and introduced the bottle. Emma's father was not sleeping much either, and they usually had a quiet chat during the pre-dawn meals while Mama stayed under the covers. Tuesday, around 4:30 a.m., David gently placed her back in the crib, turned off the light, and eased from the room. He went to the kitchen, made coffee, and as it brewed, he went online to check the news, weather, and law blogs. One blog in particular had followed the Creox litigation and the Klopek trial, and David was tempted to ignore it, but he could not. The headline read, "Mauling in Courtroom 2314. The blogger, known as the Hung Juror, obviously had too much time on his hands, or perhaps he was one of the Rogan Rothberg grunts. He wrote, "For those with a morbid sense of curiosity, hustle on over to Courtroom 2314 in the Dirksen Federal Building today for round two of the world's first, and probably only, Creox trial. For those of you who cannot attend, it's like watching a train wreck in slow motion, and a hell of a lot of fun to boot. Yesterday, opening day, the jurors and spectators were treated to the gruesome sight of the widow Iris Klopek testifying by video. Supposedly she cannot attend the trial for medical reasons, though one of my spies saw her shopping for groceries yesterday at the Dominic's on Pulaski Road. Click here for photos. This gal is one heavy woman, and when her face hit the screen yesterday, it was quite a shock. At first, she seemed, well, rather stoned, but as the deposition wore on, the drugs seemed to wear off. She even managed a few tears when talking about her beloved Percy, who died at 48 years and 320 pounds. Iris wants the jury to give her a truckload of cash, and she tried her best to evoke sympathy. Didn't work. Most of the jurors were thinking the same thing I was thinking. If you people weren't so big, you wouldn't have so many health problems. Her dream team, now minus its leader, who had a heart attack of his own last week when he came face to face with a real jury, has made only one brilliant move so far.
and that was to keep Iris out of the courtroom and away from the jury. No more brilliance is expected from these two lightweights. Their second witness was their star expert, a certified quack from Russia, who has, so far, after 15 years in the country, failed to master the most rudimentary elements of the English language. His name is Igor, and when Igor speaks, no one listens. Igor could easily have been bounced by the defense on the grounds that he is unqualified. His deficiencies are too numerous to mention, but it seems as though the defense has adopted a strategy of allowing the plaintiff's lawyers all the room they need to prove they have no case whatsoever. The defense wants Igor on the stand. He helps their side.
Enough. David closed his laptop and went for the coffee. He showered and dressed quietly, kissed Helen goodbye, peeked in on Emma, then headed out. When he turned on to Preston, he noticed the lights were on at Finley and Fig. It was 5:45, and Wally was hard at work.
Good, thought David. Maybe the junior partner had discovered some new theory they could spring on Nadine Karras and Harry Seawright and reduce some of the humiliation. But Wally's car was not parked behind the building. The rear door was unlocked, as was the front. AC was prowling around the first floor, agitated. Wally was not in his office. He was not to be found. David locked the doors and went to his office upstairs, followed by AC. There were no messages on his desk, no emails. He called Wally's cell and got voicemail. Strange, but then Wally's routine often varied. However, neither he nor Oscar had ever left the office unlocked and the lights on. David tried to review some materials but couldn't concentrate. His nerves were edgy because of the trial, and now there was a nagging sense that something else was wrong. He walked downstairs and had a quick look around Wally's office. The wastebasket next to his credenza was empty. David hated to do it, but he pulled open a few drawers and found nothing of interest. In the kitchen, next to the narrow fridge, there was a tall, round wastebasket where the coffee grounds were dumped, along with food containers and empty bottles and cans. David removed the white plastic liner, opened it wide, and found what he was afraid he might find. To one side, lying on top of a yogurt container, was an empty pint bottle of Smirnoff vodka. David removed it, rinsed it in the sink while he washed his hands, and took it upstairs, where he sat it on his desk and stared at it for a long time. Wally had a few beers during lunch, then spent part of the night at the office drinking vodka, and at some point decided to leave. Evidently, he was drunk because he left the lights on and the doors unlocked. They had agreed to meet at 7 a.m. for coffee and a work session. By 7:15, David was worried. He called Rochelle and asked if she had heard from Wally. No, is something wrong? She asked, as if a bad phone call about Wally was never unexpected. No, just looking for him, that's all. You'll be in at 8, right? I'm leaving the apartment now. I'll run by and check on Oscar, then come to the office. David wanted to call Oscar, but could not bring himself to do so. His triple bypass had been 6 days earlier, and David was not about to upset him. He paced the floor, fed AC, and tried Wally's cell again. Nothing. Rochelle arrived promptly at 8 with the news that Oscar was doing okay and had not seen Wally. He didn't come home last night, she said. David pulled the empty pint bottle out of his back pants pocket and said, I found this in the kitchen wastebasket. Wally got drunk last night here and left the doors unlocked and the lights on when he left. Rochelle stared at the bottle and wanted to cry. She had nursed Wally through his previous battles and she had cheered him on through his rehabs. She had held his hand, prayed for him, cried for him, and celebrated with him as he joyfully counted the days of sobriety. 1 year, 2 weeks, and 2 days, and now they were looking at an empty bottle. I guess the pressure got to him, David said. When he falls hard, David, and each one is worse than the last. David set the bottle on the table. But he was so proud of being sober, he said. I can't believe this. What he really couldn't believe was that the Dream Team, or the Three Stooges, was down to its last man standing. And though his partners were woefully lacking in trial experience, they were seasoned veterans compared with him. You think he'll show up in court? David asked. No, she did not, but Rochelle didn't have the heart to be blunt. Probably so. You need to get on the road. It was a long drive downtown. David called Helen and broke the news. She was as bewildered as her husband and offered the opinion that the judge would have no choice but to postpone the proceedings. David liked the sound of that, and by the time he parked, he was convinced that if Wally didn't show, he could prevail upon Judge Seawright to grant a continuance.
In all fairness, losing the two lead lawyers in a case was surely grounds for either a mistrial or a postponement. Wally was not in the courtroom. David sat alone at counsel table as the Rogan-Rothberg team filed in and the spectators took their seats. At 8:50, David eased over to a bailiff and said he needed to see Judge Seawright and it was urgent.
"Follow me," the bailiff said.
Judge Seawright had just put on his black robe when David entered his chambers. Skipping the greetings, David said, "Judge, we have a problem. Mr. Figg is AWOL. He's not here, and I don't think he'll show up." The judge exhaled in frustration and continued to slowly zip up his robe.
"You don't know where he is?"
"No, sir." Judge Seawright looked at the bailiff and said, "Go fetch Ms. Karras." When Nadine arrived alone, she and David sat with the judge at the end of his long conference table. David told them all that he knew and pulled no punches about Wally's history with alcohol. They were sympathetic and uncertain about what this meant for the trial. David confessed that he felt thoroughly unprepared and inadequate to handle whatever was left to be done, but at the same time he could not imagine the firm attempting to try the case again. "Let's face it," he said, holding nothing back. "We don't have much of a case, and we knew that when we started. We've pushed this thing about as far as we can, and we've done so only to avoid sanctions and malpractice suits."
"You want a continuance?" the judge asked.
"Yes, I think it's only fair under the circumstances." Nadine said,
"My client will resist any effort to delay matters, and I'm certain it will push hard to finish this trial."
Judge Seawright said, "I'm not sure a continuance will work. If Mr. Figg is back on the booze and drinking so much he fails to show up for court, it might take some time to get him detoxed again and ready for action. I am not inclined to consider a continuance."
David could not argue with this logic.
"Judge, I have no idea what to do out there. I've never tried a case before."
"I have not detected a great deal of experience on the part of Mr. Figg. You can certainly perform at his level."
There was a long pause as the three contemplated their rather unique dilemma. Finally, Nadine said, "I have a deal. If you will finish the trial, I will convince my client to forget Rule 11 sanctions."
Judge Seawright chimed in quickly.
"Mr. Zink, if you will finish the trial, I guarantee there will be no sanctions against you or your client."
"Great, but what about the malpractice claims?"
Nadine said nothing, but the judge replied,
"I doubt you'll be in trouble there. I'm not aware of a successful malpractice action against a lawyer who simply lost a trial."
"Nor am I," Nadine added. "There's a winner and a loser in every trial."
Of course, David thought, and it must be nice to win every time.
"Let's do this," the judge said. "We'll stand in recess today, I'll send the jury home, and you do your best to find Mr. Figg. If by chance he shows up tomorrow, we'll continue as if nothing happened, and I will not punish him for today. If you don't find him, or if he's unable to continue, then we'll resume the proceedings at 9 in the morning. You do your best, and I'll help you as much as I possibly can. We'll finish the trial, and that will be the end of it."
"What about an appeal?" Nadine asked. "Losing the two lead lawyers might make a convincing argument for a new trial."
David managed to smile and said, "I promise you there will be no appeal, not that I'm involved in. This case could very well bankrupt our little firm. We borrowed money to litigate this far. I can't imagine my partners wasting another moment fooling with an appeal. If they were to somehow win one, then they would be forced to come back here and try the case again. That's the last thing they want."
"All right, so we have a deal?" the judge asked.
"As far as I'm concerned, we do," replied Nadine.
"Mr. Zink?"
David had no choice. Continue alone, and he would save the firm from the threat of sanctions and probably malpractice as well. His only other option would be to demand a continuance and, when that was denied, refuse to participate in the trial.
"Sure, it's a deal."
He took his time driving back to the office. He continually reminded himself that he was only 32, that this would not ruin his career as a lawyer. Somehow he would survive the next 3 days. A year from now, it would almost be forgotten. Still no sign of Wally. David locked himself in his office and spent the rest of the day reading transcripts of other trials, poring over the depositions from other cases, studying the rules of procedure and evidence, and fighting the urge to throw up. Over dinner, he poked at his food as he replayed everything for Helen.
"How many attorneys are on the other side?" she asked.
"I don't know, too many to count. At least 6, with another row of paralegals packed behind them.
And you'll be alone at your table?
That's the scenario.
She chewed on a bite of pasta, then said, Does anyone check the credentials of the paralegals?
I don't think so. Why?
Just thinking, maybe I should be a paralegal for the next few days. I've always wanted to watch a trial.
David laughed for the first time in hours.
Come on, Helen. I'm not sure I want you or anyone else to witness the slaughter.
What would the judge say if I showed up with a briefcase and a legal pad and started taking notes?
At this point, I think Judge Seawright would cut me a lot of slack.
I can get my sister to keep Emma.
David laughed again, but the idea was gaining momentum. What was there to lose? It could well be the first and last trial of his career as a litigator. Why not have a little fun?
I like it, he said.
Did you say there are 7 men on the jury?
Yes.
Short skirt or long?
Not too short.
Chapter 41. The hung juror blogged on. A brief day in the Klopek-Krayox trial as the dream team had trouble getting itself together. Word on the street is that the lead lawyer, the Honorable Wallace T. Figg, failed to answer the bell and his rookie sidekick was sent to look for him. Figg wasn't seen in the courtroom just before 9 a.m. Judge Seawright sent the jury home with instructions to return this morning. Repeated calls to the Finley and Figg office went straight to voicemail, none returned by the staff, if the firm does indeed have a staff. Wonder if Figg is on a bender? Fair question in light of the fact that he's had at least 2 DUIs in the past 12 years, the last one a year ago. My records show that Figg has been married and divorced 4 times. I tracked down wife number 2, and she recalled that Wally's always battled the bottle. When contacted at her home yesterday, the plaintiff, Iris Klopek, who was still allegedly too sick to come to court, replied, I'm not surprised, when told that her lawyer had failed to show. Then she hung up. Noted legal malpractice lawyer Bart Shaw has been seen sneaking around the courtroom. Rumor is that Shaw might pick up the pieces of the Krayox mess and go after Finley and Figg for botching the cases. So far, the Klopek case has not been botched, in theory. The jury has not decided. Stay tuned. David scanned other blogs as he ate a granola bar at his desk and waited for Wally, though he really didn't expect him. No one had heard a word. Oscar, Rochelle, Deanna, a couple of lawyer buddies from his former poker club. Oscar had called a pal at the police station for an informal inquiry, though neither he nor David suspected foul play. According to Rochelle, Wally once disappeared for a week without a peep, then called Oscar from a motel in Green Bay, pickled. David was getting a lot of Wally the drunk stories, and he found them odd because he had known only the sober Wally. Rochelle arrived early and climbed the stairs, something she rarely did. She was concerned about David and offered to help in any way. He thanked her and began packing files in his briefcase. She fed AC, got her yogurt, and was arranging her desk when she looked at her emails. David, she yelled. It was from Wally, dated October 26th, 5:10 a.m., sent from his iPhone. RG, hey, I'm alive. Don't call the police and don't pay the ransom. WF.
Thank heavens, Rochelle said. He's okay.
He doesn't say he's okay, he just says he's alive. I suppose that's a good thing.
What does he mean by ransom, she wondered.
Probably his effort to be funny. Ha ha. David called Wally's cell phone 3 times as he drove downtown. His voicemail was full.
In a room filled with somber men in dark suits, a beautiful woman attracts far more attention than she would by simply walking down a busy street. Nadine Karras had used her looks like a weapon as she had risen to the top of the elite courtroom advocates in the Chicago area. On Wednesday, she had some competition. Finley and Figg's new paralegal arrived at 8:45 and, as planned, went straight to Ms. Karras and introduced herself as Helen Hancock, maiden name, one of the part-time paralegals at Finley and Figg. Then she introduced herself to several of the other defense lawyers, causing all of them to stop whatever they were working on, stand awkwardly, shake hands, smile, and be nice. At 5'8" and wearing 4-inch heels, Helen was a few inches taller than Nadine, and she looked down on some of the others as well. With her hazel eyes and chic designer frames, not to mention the slender figure and skirt 6 inches above the knees, Helen succeeded in slightly disrupting the pregame rituals, if only for a moment. The spectators, almost all men, looked her over. Her husband, who was ignoring all of this, pointed to a chair behind his and said in a lawyerly fashion, "Get me those files."
Then in a lower voice, he said, "You look spectacular, but don't smile at me."
"Yes, boss," she said, unfastening a briefcase, one of several in his collection. "Thanks for coming." An hour earlier, from his desk, David had emailed Judge Seawright and Nadine Karras with the news that Mr. Figg had been heard from but would not be in court. They did not know where he was or when they might actually see him. For all David knew, Wally could be back in Green Bay in a motel, comatose and pickled, though he kept this to himself. Dr. Igor Borsov was reintroduced to the proceedings and took the stand with the look of a leper about to be stoned. Judge Seawright said, "You may cross-examine, Miss Karras." She walked to the podium in another killer outfit, a lavender-knit dress that fit snug and did an outstanding job of showcasing her shapely and quite firm backside, and a thick brown leather belt that was pulled tight to announce, "Yes, I'm in a size 4. She began by offering the expert a lovely smile and asking him to speak slowly because she had trouble understanding on Monday. Borsov mumbled incoherently in return. With so many obvious targets, it was impossible to predict where she might attack first. David had been unable to prepare Borsov, not that he wanted to spend another minute with the man. "Dr. Borsov, when was the last time you treated a patient of your own?" He had to think for a moment and eventually said, "About 10 years. This led to a series of questions about what exactly he had been doing for the past 10 years. He had not been seeing patients, nor teaching, nor researching, nor doing all the things one would expect a doctor to do. Finally, when she had excluded virtually everything, she asked, "Isn't it true, Dr. Borsov, that for the past 10 years you have worked exclusively for various trial lawyers?" Borsov squirmed a bit. He wasn't so sure about that. Nadine was. She had the facts all gleaned from a deposition given by Borsov in another case 1 year earlier. Armed with the details, she took him by the hand and led him down the path of destruction. Year by year, she went through the lawsuits, the screenings, the drugs, and the lawyers, and when she finished an hour later, it was clear to everyone in the courtroom that Igor Borsov was nothing but a rubber stamper for the mass tort bar. On her legal pad, the paralegal slipped David a note. "Where did you find this guy?" David wrote back, "Impressive, huh? And his fee is only $75,000. "Paid by whom?" "You don't want to know." Evidently, the hot seat affected his diction, or perhaps Borsov did not wish to be understood. At any rate, he became increasingly more difficult to understand. Nadine kept her cool, so much so that David seriously doubted if she ever lost it. He was watching a master, and he was taking notes, not to help resuscitate his witness, but on effective cross-examination techniques. The jurors could not have cared less. They were gone, checked out, already waiting for the next witness. Nadine sensed this and began culling her list of problem areas. At 11 a.m., Judge Seawright needed a potty break and called a 20-minute recess. When the jury left the courtroom, Borsov approached David and asked, "How much longer?" "I have no idea," David replied. The doctor was sweating and breathing heavy. His armpits were wet. "Too bad," David wanted to say. "At least you're getting paid." During the recess, Nadine Karras and her team made the tactical decision to stay away from a replaying of Percy's echocardiogram. With Borsov bloodied and on the ropes, the echo might allow him to regain some footing since he could once again lose the jury with medical jargon. After the recess, when Borsov slowly returned to the witness chair, she began chipping away at his education with a heavy emphasis on the differences between med school here and med school in Russia. She went through a list of courses and lectures, standard here but unheard of over there. She knew the answer to every question she asked, and Borsov, by now, knew this. He became increasingly more hesitant to give a response directly, knowing that any discrepancy, however slight, would be pounced upon, dissected, and slung back at him. She hammered away at his training and managed to trip him a few times. By noon, the jurors, though still watching the mayhem, had the clear impression of a doctor they wouldn't trust to prescribe lip balm. Why had he never written any papers? He claimed there had been some in Russia, but was forced to admit they had not been translated. Why had he never taught or joined a faculty? The classroom bored him, he tried to explain, though it was painful to imagine Borsov attempting to communicate with a group of students. During lunch, David and his paralegal hustled out of the building and went to a deli around the corner. Helen was fascinated by the proceedings, but still stunned by Dr. Borsov's pathetic showing. "Just for the record," she said over a spring salad, "if we ever reach the point of a divorce,
I'm hiring Nadine.
Oh, really? Well, then I'll be forced to hire Wally Figg if I can keep him sober.
You're toast.
Forget the divorce, baby. You're too cute and you have great potential as a courtroom paralegal.
Helen grew serious and said, Look, I realize you have a lot on your mind right now, but you must be thinking about the future. You can't stay at Finley and Figg. What if Oscar can't come back? What if Wally can't kick the booze? And assuming they can, why would you want to stay there?
I don't know. I haven't had much time to think about it. He had shielded her from the twin nightmares of the Rule 11 sanctions and the potential malpractice cases, and he had decided not to tell her about the $200,000 line of credit he had guaranteed along with the two partners. Leaving the firm in the near future was not likely.
Let's talk about it later, he said.
I'm sorry, it's just that I think you can do so much better, that's all.
Thank you, dear. What, you're not impressed with my courtroom skills?
You're brilliant, but I suspect one big trial might be enough for you.
By the way, Nadine Karras doesn't do divorces.
Then that settles it. I guess I'll just tough it out.
At 1:30, Borzov tottered to the witness stand for the last time, and Nadine began her final assault. Since he was a cardiologist who didn't treat patients, it was safe to assume he never treated Percy Klopek. True, plus Mr. Klopek had been dead for a long time before Borzov was hired as an expert. But surely he had consulted the doctors who did treat him. No, Borzov admitted, he had not. Feigning disbelief, she began hammering away at this incredible oversight. His responses grew slower, his voice weaker, his Russian thicker, until finally, at 2:45, Borzov pulled a white handkerchief from a coat pocket and began waving it. Such drama was not contemplated by the wise folks who wrote the rules of federal trial procedure, and David was uncertain about what he should do. He stood and said, Your Honor, I think this witness has had enough.
Dr. Borzov, are you okay? Judge Seawright asked. The answer was obvious. The witness shook his head no.
Nothing further, Your Honor, Miss Karras announced and left the podium. Another impressive annihilation under her belt.
Any redirect, Mr. Zink? The judge asked.
The last thing David wanted to do was to try to revive a dead witness.
No, sir, he said quickly. Dr. Borzov, you're excused.
He staggered away with the aid of a bailiff, $75,000 richer, but with another black mark on his resume. Judge Seawright recessed court until 3:30.
Dr. Herbert Threadgill was a pharmacologist of dubious reputation. He, like Borzov, was spending the waning days of his career living the easy life, away from the rigors of real medicine, doing nothing but testifying for lawyers who needed his notoriously pliant opinions to fit their version of the facts. The paths of both professional testifiers crossed occasionally, and they knew each other well. Threadgill had been reluctant to sign on for the Klopek case for three reasons. The facts were lousy,